Recording has started. Speakers, you may begin.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So welcome to the Crest Community Working Group on Enhancing ICANN's Accountability, meeting number 23 on April the 21st, 2015. This call is being recorded, as you may be aware. May I kindly remind you to state your names for the record when speaking, and of course, mute your lines when you are not using them. And for effects of the roll call, may I call for anyone that is not in the Adobe Connect room, but it's on the phone bridge, to state their name, just in case, so we can add your name for the roll call properly.
Hi, Leon. It's Holly Gregory here. I'll be on the Adobe Connect in just a minute, but right now I'm just on the phone.
Thank you very much, Holly. You're an expert now. So Holly's attendance is noted for the record, and she will be joining us shortly in the Adobe Connect room. So anyone else on the phone bridge that is not at the Adobe Connect room at this point? Okay, so having no one else on the phone bridge that is not on the Adobe Connect, of course, the regular reminder for filling in your SOIs. If you haven't done so by call 23, that would be worrisome, so please do fill in your SOIs, and if you need help, of course, feel free to approach anyone from staff so you can get help on doing so. We'll be having an update from the CWG coaches, and I think that Jonathan and Lisa will be joining us shortly. And, well, for the time being, I'd like to turn to Thomas to continue on our next agenda point.
Yes, this is Thomas Rickert speaking. Hello again. Actually, since Jonathan and Lisa are still on another call, which is running late, and I can't really predict how long it will take.
Okay.
And since we need both of them to have this discussion, can I suggest that we do the third agenda item on stress tests first and move to the second agenda item on CWG collaboration afterwards?
Sounds good to me, Thomas. So with this, if we all agree, then we could go to Matthew for agenda item number 3.
Thank you, Leon. This is Mathieu Vaille speaking. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this first of a series of calls this week. I do hope that we will manage to meet our agenda and timeline this week, at least. So the next agenda item was addressing the stress tests. And the point of this agenda item is to update on a short number of stress tests, which are particularly relevant to the recommendations we may have to look at during the later intense work days we have this week. And for an update on this, I am not sure whether Cheryl has been able to join us. Yes, I see Cheryl in the AC room. And Cheryl, are you able to provide us with a short introduction on this? I see you're in. If Cheryl is not able, then we have Steve Delianco, who could probably chime in. The goal of this is to look at stress test number 18 first, then number 14 and 15, and if time allows, 11 and 17, but at least we should certainly look at 18, which was regarding the GAC consensus and operating principles. So I am turning to Steve Delianco. Steve, if you're here, because Cheryl has is experiencing difficult local situation in at home. So I think her access to connectivity is a bit restricted. Steve, I see you in the AC room. I don't know if you can...
I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Steve, can you introduce Stresses 18, please?
Thank you, Matthew. Steve Talbianco, GNSO and CSG and Stress Test Work Team. We have three stress tests that made their way into recommendations in the draft document that's in the Adobe Connect. There are 26 stress tests in all, and they relied upon recommendations that are already here, especially for independent review and blocking bylaws and budgets, in order to show that we have adequately provided a community accountability. But three of them required some rather small changes to the bylaws. And those are in our document at the tail end of the AOC section. So you wanted to cover 18 first. And stress test 18 is actually on page 73 of the document that's in the Adobe. That's page 73, and it has to do with GAC advice. This is stress test number 18. So the concept here was that the GAC could change anytime it wishes the method that it uses to arrive at the advice that it sends to ICANN. And, of course, it can use consensus, it can use majority, it might even have varied forms of advice. But the ICANN bylaws today in Section 11 require ICANN to enter a consultation to try to find a mutually acceptable solution, and it's required for any GAC advice. It doesn't qualify that by suggesting that only GAC consensus advice or other forms of threshold would be necessary. So Stress Test 18 suggested that we should modify the ICANN bylaws such that when the GAC has arrived at advice through consensus, then that would be triggering the bylaws provision to require trying to work out a mutually acceptable solution. Other forms of GAC advice that didn't quite come to consensus or perfectly acceptable would be giving quite a bit of consideration by ICANN, would not require the bylaws provision of working out a mutually acceptable solution. All right, and the way that that works its way into the document is, what did you put in the chat? You put page 13 in the document, but I'm not sure it's on page 13, though. I'm looking at the agenda to the right. I don't believe that's actually where it is.
Steve, it's Jordan here. The part of the Working Party 1 stuff that makes a recommendation about how to deal with Stress Test 18 starts on page 54 of the PDF.
Thanks, Jordan. So, folks, if you're scrolling to page 54, you'll see where Stress Test 18 made its way into our recommendations, and this is part of Work Party 1. So on page 54 was the requirement that the GAC use consensus if it wants to trigger the bylaws provision. So the change is right at the bottom of page 55 and the top of page 56. We showed you both provisions, J and K, from the ICANN bylaws, and the sentence that is being added is in bold and underline, and it says, with respect to governmental advisory committee advice that is supported by consensus. And I did want to note that several weeks ago, when we were reacting to Stress Test 18, we had gone so far as to say that the bylaws should enshrine the current method that the GAC uses to arrive at advice, and that's in the GAC policies and procedures, and it says that consensus is the absence of any formal objection. We had discussions with several GAC members, the co-chairs and rapporteurs, and actually figured that one way we could diffuse some of that concern was to simply refer to consensus, allowing the GAC to define what it means by consensus, so that if it felt that the absence of a single objection was too high a bar, the GAC can come up with a definition of consensus in much the same way that the GNSO and CCNSO define our own definition of consensus when we rely upon that in sending it to the board. So on page 56, I laid out four particular points about this that I wanted to reiterate before we take questions. The first is this does not interfere with the GAC's method of decision-making. The GAC can do whatever it wishes, and it can adopt advice by whatever voting method it wishes. All this suggests is a carrot, an incentive to say that if consensus were used by the GAC, and that's what the GAC uses today, then that advice has to be taken into account in the sense, in the extent of having to have a mutually acceptable solution, or at least to try. Okay? And even if the case the GAC was producing advice simple by simple majority or some other way, ICANN still has to explain if it chooses not to follow that GAC advice. It has to explain, no matter what, whether it's consensus or not. So the only effect of this change is to sort of raise the bar for the kind of advice where ICANN is obligated to try in good faith and in a timely and efficient manner to find a mutually acceptable solution. Now, NTIA, U.S. Commerce Department, gave specific requirements for a general concept of the transition of not to have ICANN become controlled by a governmental or intergovernmental body. And that is a broad context that contributed to the development of the stress test, but it wasn't a direct cause and effect. However, I did want to note that right after we introduced this concept of adding that bylaws change, a handful of GAC members exchanged open emails on the list, and one did come as the official position of NTIA, who considered that this particular bylaws change was necessary to fulfill NTIA's condition with respect to avoiding governmental or intergovernmental capture of ICANN. And while that connection is one that some might feel is a stretch, this work party and the CCWG is considering this bylaws change on the basis of being sure that ICANN is accountable to the full community and not in just one special case where a simple majority of GAC members could trigger a bylaws obligation to work out a mutually acceptable solution. That doesn't exist for any other body in ICANN. And in situations where the board has deference to decisions, it's only where there's consensus behind the decision that comes from an AC or an SO. So this is an attempt to bring that onto par, but in addition, it satisfies an explicit requirement that's been articulated by NTIA. So I'll stop there, Matthew and Thomas, and however you want to handle it. Do you want to take questions?
This is Mathieu speaking. Yes, I think we're going to take questions. Before turning to Cavus, who's first in line, I'd like to really commend the stress test and the various work party groups for the significant amount of work that's been done on this particular stress test and listening and taking into account the various inputs we've received from a number of stakeholders, including some of the GAC members in the CCWG. And I hope our discussion will enable us to move forward in terms of what we put into a public comment, bearing in mind that obviously this is in no way binding to any party at this point. So I'm turning to Cavus for the first question.
Thank you, Matthew. I discussed this issue, unfortunately, two persons, they disagreed with me and pushed me not to further have any debate. Rule or principle 47 is quite clear. That by consensus, and where the consensus is not possible, provide full range of views expressed by members. If, and only if, we wish to also provide the flexibility to GAC to have other procedures than consensus, and in the absence of consensus, full range of the views, we could do it differently. We could say GAC may also amend rules or principle 47 to decide on certain cases by majority. Full stop. Nothing more and nothing less. That means GAC remains with consensus. If consensus is not reached, wide range of different views. However, for certain cases, depending on the GAC decision, there could be a majority decisions. This is point one. Point two, reference to the issue that transition should not end up that any government or group of government have control is a general principles or conditions of NTIA and is not limited to GAC. It's covered the entire transitions. There are five conditions and this is one of the conditions. I suggest that we do not go that far and asking the GAC may change its principle 47 and have majority voting. He's saying that may also consider to amend its principle 47 to have voting by majority on certain cases. That is my view, and I said that this is an issue need to be discussed in GAC. Unfortunately, GAC has not had the opportunity to do that. Reference was made that we have received comment of chair of the GAC. I have read several times the GAC chair's letter to the CCWG, and exactly it said rule 47 or principle 47. And it says that it is the view of certain GAC members, but not entire GAC. So I think that we should be very cautious and we should not go too far. Once again, NTIA condition covers everything in transition and not limited to GAC advice. And second, GAC should still have the possibility to do whatever wishes, consensus, majority, or range of possibilities. So we made a very small changes to the bylaw saying, as I mentioned, GAC may also consider to have majority views on certain cases. And this is leave it to the GAC to decide. Thank you.
Thank you, Caruso. And I observed that there remains a significant amount of time available for the GAC to consider this in sessions because obviously no final recommendation will be made by our group before Buenos Aires, and so that leaves a significant amount of time. And I'm turning to Becky now.
Hi. I just wanted to provide some historical perspective. Steve mentioned that the ICANN bylaws, these provisions were put into place in 2003 as part of the evolution and reform, don't require ICANN or GAC advice to be by consensus. That is because at the time GAC advice was consensus and there was no discussion or conception that GAC advice could be anything other than consensus-based. So the absence of that language from the current bylaws simply reflects the state of affairs and the expectations at the time the current bylaws were written. The second thing I'd like to say is it seems to me, I take Caruso's point that maybe there could be, advice from the GAC that comes out that is based on a majority vote. Nothing that is proposed in the stress test would preclude any kind of advice at all, whether it's majority vote or super majority vote or consensus as it is. It's only about the situation in which ICANN must sit down and reach an agreeable compromise with the GAC. And I think we need to keep that in mind. We are not talking about the ability of the GAC to give advice in any form or manner that it wants. And second, given the extraordinary authority that the GAC advice has when it is providing advice, I think it is a reasonable thing to say that the community should expect GAC advice that it has is close, very close to being a veto, that when that that kind of deference is given to the GAC advice, it should be with the consensus of the GAC.
Thank you, Becky. That's a very good point. And I'm trusting that the following speakers are mindful of time and try and make their points concisely. And I know Rulof is quite good at that, so I'm turning to Rulof now.
Thank you, Mathieu. Rulof Meyer, for the record, can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay. Well, I've made this point before. I object to this change in the bylaws, not because our content is really very important or will have a large impact, but for two reasons. One being out of principle. I think, in my opinion, we are selecting one particular advisory committee and are trying to influence the way, not the way they make decisions, as Steve rightly points out, but the way they give their advice to the ICANN board. And the second reason is, and that's the most important one to me, this thing has the potential to really slow us down. And I think for the wrong reasons, because although we might expect that we get more advice from the GAC if we change from consensus advice to majority advice, that does not automatically mean that the GAC will have more influence, because the ICANN board can still reject the advice and do something else. And if the board chooses to follow the advice of the GAC, a majority advice, against the interest of the rest of the community will have new powers to block that. So I don't think it's really important to have this change on one hand, and on the other hand, I think it has the potential to really become an issue that will slow us down.
Thank you, Rolf. The point to our taken. I will close the queue after Greg so that we can move to another item. And next is Jordan.
Thanks, Matthew. Jordan Carter here for the record. I agree with what Becky said and would only add two things. One is that we don't give any other advisory committees the same kind of deference in their advice that we give GAC in the bylaws. So that GAC is a special case that responds to Rulof's point. The other point is we've already said in our debates that we can't give individual SOs and ACs veto or acceptance rights over any particular part of this proposal. So when you come back to the point that nothing in this would affect the GAC's decision-making, it only affects how the ICANN board has to go into a reconciliation negotiation, and it doesn't entrench the current level of consensus by copying the language out of the GAC operating principles. It simply censors to give a bit of flexibility. This is a proposal that's moved a long way from where it was originally, and I support its inclusion in our public comment doc.
Thank you, Jordan. Greg?
Thank you. Greg Shatton for the record. Just to follow on, you know, GAC advice does get an exceptional amount of deference in the bylaws, but that's not merely because it's advice from the GAC. It's because it's consensus advice. As Becky pointed out, the current language did not contemplate the idea that there could be a change from consensus advice, so essentially the language is now anachronistic. The suggestion here is really only one that would fix that problem. The board should not be forced to give the same amount of deference to a majority or range of views type of document from the GAC as it does currently for consensus advice from the GAC. It seems pretty straightforward. And it's, lastly, this is really aimed on, this is aimed only at the board and its activities in receiving and reacting to GAC advice. This does not in any way constrain the GAC from taking any decisions it wants to change its level of advice. It just doesn't get to carry along the same amount of deference that it currently gets for giving consensus GAC advice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. James, the queue was closed. Is that something very new and very important you have to add? No. Okay, thank you very much, James. I appreciate it. What I would do to recap is I think we're speaking about a range of views within the GAC and everything, and we have the range of views in our group right now on this topic, and it's very valuable. I'd like to remind you that was noted in the chat that obviously what we're discussing here at this point is the opportunity to introduce that proposal into a public comment, an interim work product of our group, and definitely not, this is not the last step towards a discussion. So we'll have a second reading of this during the intense work days, and we'll have several options, including proposing various scenarios. I would recommend as an action item out of this call that maybe Cavus and Roloff at least put their comments in writing so that we can at least have them as material input into the second reading, and that everyone just considers this as whether it's appropriate at this point to put this into our interim proposal, considering that the GAC will obviously take some time to discuss this, and that's at least that's what I would expect at its next meetings, and that we, before we finalize our proposals, we would have some formal feedback on this, including from the public comment if necessary or through other formats. And so I think that's something we need to be very careful on. So that's that would be my conclusion. So I'd like to see in the notes the suggested action items for Cavus and Roloff to put their comments in writing. And we'll continue this conversation with this in mind during the intense work day. I'm not seeing the action items in the notes, so I'm a bit concerned, but that's just a matter of time. With that, I think we'll just suspend the stress test item because I'm conscious that we have Lee and Jonathan, the co-chairs of the TWG, on the call, and I mean, they've had very, very long calls as well as a significant call just a few minutes ago, so I'd like to give them the opportunity to be released after the presenters with their update. And so I'm turning to Thomas to lead that part of the call, and then we'll come back to the stress tests 14 and 15. Thomas?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Thomas Rickert speaking, and I'd like to welcome Lisa Spur and Jonathan Robinson to this call. As Mathieu said, we know that you're under a lot of time pressure, so we're not going to keep you on this call for too long, but we really appreciate you taking the time to speak to our group. The whole group does know from regular updates that we give that we are liaising regularly with each other. We have weekly calls, and we have additional meetings whenever we can. And we think now we're at a point in time where actually the work conducted by both groups needs to be woven together much more than previously. And we've asked, or there has been an exchange of correspondence on certain items where the CWG has been requesting input and support from the CCWG. And I would really like to hand it over to the two of you. I'm not sure who goes first to provide us with a status quo of where you are on the things where you need input from us, and maybe a little bit on the overall status of your recommendations.
Thank you, Thomas. It's Jonathan Robinson speaking, and I'll lead, and then Lisa will pick up on some of the detail points. You're right, we've just finished a two-hour meeting, a meeting of the full CWG, And the purpose of that meeting was to review the draft proposal in the current state that it is in now. And we did a page turn in particular of Section 3 and a couple of key annexes. The way in which we've structured that proposal is to be directly comparable insofar as it's possible with those submitted by the other communities. So we've had the advantage of being able to see their proposals and recognize the formatting. But that's not only done for that reason. It was done recognizing that our proposal was missed the original ICG deadline. And so in crafting our proposal that way and putting a significant amount of detail into annexes, we were able to structure it such that we hope we have assisted at least the reconciliation of our proposal with that of the other groups. And clearly that's the job of the ICG, but that was one key objective of structuring it in that way. That draft proposal is in a version, it happens to be 3.4. It's been through various iterations, and we are still on track to attempt to publish that for public comment tomorrow. I expect we'll use every last minute of whatever tomorrow might be defined as. There's a lot of work to be done to synthesize it all into the final version of the proposal. But having done so, that will then kick off a 28-day public comment period. Clearly, there's a judgment to be made there between making it on the length of the proposal, but the drivers are in terms of key time frames are really driven by our need, if we are to stick to our timetable of having and the ability to process the public comments, to reformat those into a final version of the proposal, and to have that proposal prepared sufficiently ahead of the Buenos Aires meeting to give the groups a due opportunity to consider it. So there really are, I mean, some pretty tight constraints that are ultimately driven by our objective to publish a final proposal for consideration at the Buenos Aires meeting. One of the techniques we've employed to assist us with doing that, or one of the issues that we've had to deal with, is to persuade ourselves as chairs and our group with us that we are able to rely on this group. And for that, we have been very grateful for both the work of this group and the close collaboration with you, Thomas, and your colleagues in the co-chair roles, Mathieu and Leon. In creating that dependence, we've in effect put work that some might have wanted us to do within our own group across to you and created what a strong dependence on the work that you are doing and the mechanism that you propose to create, such that we will be able to rely on those. And it is our expectation that our proposal is likely to be conditional on those mechanisms being implemented. So whilst we don't have to be entirely synchronous in our work with you, we are very dependent on your performance as a group to support our performance. We are interlinked. And I know some in the community would have liked this to have been one big piece of work. Given the way it's panned out, I think we've managed very well with the two separate tracks of work in the CWG and the CCWG, stewardship and accountability. But we are very dependent on you. And we will ask the lawyers that are working with us and assisting us to help us to craft and institutionalize or formalize that conditional dependence of our proposal on the critical mechanisms that you are working on. I think that covers, in a nutshell, what I would like to say. There is a memo in front of you, which is an attachment we sent to you recently with some specific points. And Lisa will probably want to highlight a couple of those. But I'm also mindful you have your own work to do and are under your own time pressures, notwithstanding those that we might seek to put on you. Thanks, Thomas.
Thanks, Jonathan, and over to Lisa.
Thank you, Thomas. And yes, I would like to echo Jonathan. It's Lisa Fool for the record, sorry. I'd like to echo Jonathan's words about how interlinked and how important it is that we have some input from you on a couple of issues. And as you can see in the memo, we have highlighted four issues that we would like you to look at. Actually, it's been down to three now because one of them has been we had a survey among the CCTLDs, and that decided that we shouldn't ask you to look at what we call an IAP, and I think we call it an independent review panel, but you call it an RFP, I think. I'm not sure about that wording. That's the last issue. That's the appeal mechanism. Sorry, I started from the end, but I think it was some good news that we actually minimized the issues so you didn't have to deal with that. That appeal mechanism was only regarding the CCTLDs and delegation, redelegation, and the issue is to be dealt with within the CCNSO. That was a response from the community. But the first one that we have is the actual ICANN budget, and while we had a design team working with ICANN and IANA staff on this budget, and they're very helpful, we still think there needs to be much more details and much more transparency regarding this. We had an email from Mathieu earlier before or during our intensive working days asking us for details. So we try to specify in our response to you what kind of details it is that we need on this. And actually, we have a lot of itemizations of the cost, but we don't have the actual number of the cost. It's in one big chunk instead of specified per item. And we try to envision this for you. The next one is the community empowerment mechanism, and we're working on having reviews and review teams, those we would like to have that you're thinking of. We're having review teams, and we need to have something to pass this on to and have a mechanism that treats those reviews and take care of that they are built into any system that you have regarding your thinking of maybe having an ADRNT kind of review or whatever. But we're planning on having specific review on IANA functions and also on maybe having an ad hoc review if necessary, and that needs to be treated in an accountability mechanism. And I see Steve Del Bianco is asking that we're not asking for any CCTLD appeals for delegation and redelegation. That's right. And then we have the last one is review and redress mechanism, where we would like to have a fundamental bylaw incorporated. And this is also tried to be specified a little further in this and why we need it. So we would like to have, in order to have a trigger mechanism, we need a bylaw to kind of to have the commitment from the board to act on anything that's raised by the review teams. So this was a very brief overview of where we are regarding those four. If you have any questions, you feel free to ask them.
Thank you very much, Lisa. This is Thomas. I would very much like to open it up to the group for questions. And I see that Kavus has raised his hands. Kavus, the floor is yours.
Yes, Jonathan and Liz, I wholeheartedly congratulate you for your hard work and tireless activities, day and night, so many meetings, putting this very, very complex document together, as I understood from your intervention for public comments. I have one general question and two small comments. The general question is that the document you propose to go to public comment, but at the same time you send it to ICG. Do you expect that ICG could consider that document before receiving the public comment? Because the public comment on the first draft was entirely different because the draft was completely different from what you have now. So what do you expect? That ICG go through this because we have tomorrow a meeting? And then when you receive public comments, you include that and send it again to the ICG? This is the question you may answer, you may not answer. But that is a related question. But now coming to comments. In your document correspondence, you refer to direct costs and indirect costs. In legal document number 18, which is now also at tonight, they referred to direct cost, but not indirect cost. They referred to direct cost and they referred to direct cost for shared resources and support function allocations. I think there seems to be some sort of different terms and language. Perhaps you should correct that, whether you talk about direct and indirect costs or you talk about direct and shared costs. I don't know shared whether it's indirect or not. This is one question. The other question, you refer to the ad hoc review, whereas in some other part of the document referred to a specific review. Again, you have to have a consistency in the language. Either you call them a specific review or ad hoc review. And the last comment is that you were talking about CCTLD, that for delegation and redelegation. Did you address the revocations also, or just you limit yourself to the comments that we should not have anything for delegation and redelegation? But what about revocations? This is something that was discussed in GAC. This is three small comments that I wish, if possible, you could reply. And I thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. This is Thomas. Jonathan, I see your hand is up, but I trust that Mathieu has another question for you. So if I may, I would like to take the liberty of hearing Mathieu first, and then let you, Jonathan, and Lisa respond to the questions from both Kavus as well as from Mathieu. Mathieu.
Thank you very much, Thomas, and I will join Kavus in congratulating Lisa and Jonathan for their hard work, which I hope is going to be rewarded with very good feedback in the upcoming public comments. But for having observed their work, it's been relentless. It's been difficult, but they have been tremendous chairs, and we look forward to their experience. I think the issues that Lisa described are very relevant to us, and they fit well in our Workstream 1 proposals, and we're basically working on all those issues, so that's very good confirmation. We have slightly different timelines in both groups, and I know, Jonathan and Lisa, you've been working on how to present your proposals in a way that is conditional upon our final approval of recommendations. And I wondered if, Jonathan, maybe you could share with us how you see this played out in the adoption of the proposals you set up and their adoptions slightly later on. The conditionality proposals you were referring to a few months ago, whether that's still appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. I think the term conditional accountability has been ceased to use because that has caused some confusion, but I think the idea is still to have conditional aspects in the work results of both groups. And with that, I'd like to turn to Jonathan and maybe Lisa to answer the questions that were raised.
sure I'll make a pass, and I think I may have to defer some. Thomas, it's Jonathan speaking, to Lisa anyway. First, Kavus raised a point on the ICG. We do not intend to submit this draft proposal to the ICG. Of course, members of the ICG are welcome to review it. I may have caused that confusion referring to the similarity of formatting and style that we have created in order to ultimately facilitate the IC or assist in facilitating the ICG's work. So that's really about the style and structure of the proposal to be as readily as possible cross-compared with that from the other communities. There was a point on direct costs and indirect costs. I accept the point, and Philip Buckingham furthered it in the chat, that we do need to make sure we're very clear on those, and that's going to be something, you know, in a sense, that's one area of linkage with you. It's how clear we are, and how clear we can clearly we can specify and understand and maintain insight into the costs of running the function. As to ad hoc review, I accept the point. There has been some change in terminology. Just to highlight, though, that these proposals have been variations of the proposal have been refined on quite a frequent basis. So it may be that an old term is carrying on, but really the key difference here is that the IANA function will be subject, in the CWG's view, to periodic review, and that periodic review will take place every 5 years, save for the first one, which will take place 2 years after transition. And in addition, there is the prospect of a special review under specific circumstances, which will, to all intents and purposes, have the same structure as a periodic review, but it can be called in, initiated under specific circumstances. I'll defer on the revocation of CCTLDs to Lisa, and perhaps she can make a comment on that. But before doing so, I'll just switch over to Mathieu's question on the conditionality. And essentially here, the idea is that the proposal we will make will say that it is dependent on the work of your group. And that is what we mean additional. Our proposal is valid insofar as it is able to rely on key accountability groups being accountability mechanisms being implemented by this group. So where that could unravel, I suppose, is should this group be sufficiently far behind in its work, should your group, the CCWG on accountability, be sufficiently far behind or insufficiently clear on those mechanisms such that the CWC will feel that it cannot rely on these. Now, I am not a lawyer, and that is why I've asked, together with Lisa, of the lawyers that are assisting us to help us frame that conditionality, that dependence on your work, such that they don't need to happen entirely coincident, but we can rely comprehensively and concretely on the outputs of this group to support the output of the ARC co-chairing. Let me hand over to Lisa.
Thank you, Jonathan. There was two issues. One was the issue regarding shared cost and indirect costs, and I think it's a very valid point, and we will try and make sure that we use the same terminology, and we will refer to it as shared resources because that's the way that I can is actually that's the words that I can are using regarding the revocation. We chose not to use that terminology in our work because this is a terminology from the framework of interpretation report, and having this sent out for a lot of CCTLDs that are not part of the CCNSO and that has not read that report, we thought it was more sensible to have the old terminology, delegation, redelegation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa and Jonathan, for answering the questions from the group. Unless there are further questions, I would like to take stock of what we have so far, and I would also like to briefly capture some of the ideas that have been suggested in the chat with respect to the reviews that you are envisaging to have. So for the regular reviews, we can put them in the section of our report where we speak to the periodic reviews that we have foreseen in our preliminary findings. But for the ad hoc reviews that you're asking for, it is my understanding that our group would very much like to hear from your group what would trigger such events so that we can adjust or add additional language to that. And maybe Avri, who's also liaison between our two groups, would like to speak to that in more detail. Avri, please.
Yes, thank you. This is Avri speaking. Hopefully I can be heard. Yeah, and I've been working on both teams in the CWG and the CCWG. So in terms of what I've seen, the review that's being offered for the IANA Funk review, which is the one that the placeholder is being held for, would be keyed off a regular calendar just like the others. The only other thing was that review could be initiated by one other process at the moment, and that's that the Customer Service Committee, the CSC, handed an issue off to the naming SOs, and the naming SOs could activate one of those reviews out of band. I see no reason why, with what's being done here, that particular sentence could not be in the description of the review going in the same section of the AOC-like reviews. So I don't actually think that it would cause that much extra complexity. It's just that in one of those reviews, we're adding an extra trigger. That is the action of the naming SOs. But otherwise, it would be the same, and it wouldn't be ad hoc. And I think ad hoc is really the wrong impression. It would be a review done exactly the same way, just initiated out of schedule. Thanks.
Thank you for elaborating on this, and I guess that your suggested language captures it quite nicely. We should keep this as an action item for our further work to put that language in the report or into our recommendations for the group to further discuss. I would suggest that the last intervention from the group is going to be made by Cavus. After that, I'm going to close the queue, and then we can move to the next agenda item. Cavus.
Yes, Thomas, I just wanted to reply to your question. Your question is answered on page 23 of the document to be released by CWG, when they refer that, as I've said, CSC could initiate this specific review. I suggest, if possible, we would not use two different terms. We use a specific review, but not ad hoc, because ad hoc has a different meaning and so on and so forth. But in fact, even this specific review by CSC now is commented that it should not be on the CSC, it should be some other things. And there are some comments on page 23 of Jonathan and Lee's document.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Cavus. So I think that for our group, what's important to remember is that I think for all areas that have been brought up by the CWG, we have possibilities to factor that into our work. We also take note of the sense of urgency that you've raised with the group and that we're all very aware of. And we will keep you updated, and you will certainly see the report if and when it's going to be published for public comment, and then you will see how we have actually made progress on these items. Lisa and Jonathan, would you like to make any closing remarks for the section? There don't seem to be any.
Thank you and the group. Thomas, I should have put my hand up just to thank you and the group for A, having us now, and B, the support and collaboration. It's been very effective, and really appreciate knowing that it's helped with the efficiency of our work. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lisa. Jonathan?
Yeah. I'd like to add it was very good to have the comments, and I think it's important that we try and use the same terminology as you do. So we take that point very seriously. Thank you.
And thank the two of you for your availability. You will now be excused for the rest of the call, although you're wholeheartedly invited to stay on. And with that, I think we can close this agenda item and turn it back over to Mathieu.
Thank you, Thomas. And I'm conscious of time, but we'll turn back to the stress test item, where we should at least, I think, cover, and it should be pretty short, stress test numbers 14 and 15, which are actually about bringing the affirmation of commitment into the bylaws one way or another. So, Steve, can you quickly introduce those stress tests so we have a first discussion on them?
Thank you, Matthew. On pages 76, 77 of our other document, which I believe staff will put back into the Adobe chat, pages 76 and 77 of our draft document, we describe stress test 14 and 15. Stress test 14 was first discussed when we all gathered in Singapore. It was the first one we went through together. And I don't need to go into too much detail here. It is simply an acknowledgement that absent the IANA contract, the likelihood that ICANN could simply quit the affirmation of commitments with 120 days notice if it didn't have the need to maintain the affirmation in order to keep the IANA contract with NTIA. We pointed out over and over again that the affirmation is a bilateral agreement between the U.S. government and ICANN, and it would likely become the very next target for governments and others who feel like no government should have a special role in its relationship or oversight of ICANN. All that is valid concern, and the response of the stress test team was to say that any commitments that ICANN makes to the community, which are embodied in the affirmation of commitments, should be moved into ICANN's bylaws, and that ought to be a work stream one requirement for the transition of the IANA contract. So that's the connection between stress test 14 and 15 and how it tracks back to page 47 of the document you have before you. Page 47, and that whole section describes affirmation of commitments that need to be brought into the bylaws. It starts at page 42. Each of them is articulated there. And Matthew, did you want to go through each of the commitments that map to it, or just specifically the affirmation of commitments item 8B with respect to the headquarters? What's your pleasure?
Well, I think we should probably just remind the principles of the main principles and probably be a little more specific about 8B.
All right. Aubrey and Matthew did lots of great work that began on page 42, where we walk through how to map the commitments they make in the affirmation, the commitments that ICANN makes to the community, and move them over into the bylaws. And as we did so, we have additional text, which Work Party 1 is recommending as part of turning those from bilateral commitments into universal commitments, as well as other changes to text that Work Party 1 was recommending. So, Matthew, if everyone turns to page 44 of this document, do we have control yet? Page 44, please. In my case, I don't think I have. There we go, 44. On last week's call, we discussed these changes. They're in bold and underlined. I'm looking for guidance from the chairs of whether you want to take a cue on each one of these commitments from the affirmation or simply summarize them and take a cue at the end.
Rather summarize and take the cue at the end, please, Steve.
Thank you, Matthew. So words that are already in the affirmation don't require a lot of explanation. But one piece of additional text on page 44 is to suggest the word global to be repeated in front of the word public interest, so it's global public interest, and that we should respect the bottom-up multi-stakeholder nature of ICANN, the bottom-up multi-stakeholder nature of ICANN. Also, the last item on page 44 is that sustain a competitive environment that enhances consumer trust and choice. Enhances consumer trust and choice. That's an example of a commitment that is actually part of the periodic review, but ought to be baked into these bylaws as well in the core values. Page 45 took a look at the affirmation of commitments, paragraph 4, where ICANN made commitments to perform and publish analysis of positive and negative effects of its decisions on the public. And that public means all public, whether you're financial, non-financial, commercial, or non-commercial. But just the same, if we bring it over to the bylaws, there's a desire to clarify it to say, including any financial or non-commercial impact on the public and the positive and negative effect on the security, stability, and resiliency of the DNS. And that was on page 45. Page 46 talked about the commitments in the affirmation in section 7. And in that respect, ICANN committed to transparent and accountable budgeting processes. We bring that over with the additional text to say, providing either reasonable or adequate advance notice to facilitate stakeholder engagement in policy decision making. Again, page 46, the idea was to add to this text so that ICANN would provide advance notice so that we stakeholders could properly engage in the policy decision making. We don't know for sure if the right word is reasonable advance notice or adequate advance notice. That's not clear. Page 47 took a look at the affirmation of commitments in paragraph 8, and it had three parts of it. To maintain the capacity and ability to coordinate the DNS, that's brought over verbatim. 8B is ICANN's commitment to remain a non-for-profit corporation headquartered in the U.S. with offices around the world to meet the needs of the global community. And what we have noted in our work party is that ICANN CEO in February this year told a Senate committee that the jurisdiction of ICANN shall remain in the U.S., and we stand by this. A number of us have noted that that created an expectation, at least in the minds of the U.S. Congress, that the absence of 8B being brought over from the affirmation would likely be noted when Congress reviews the transition proposal. Now, I do want to note that since we discussed this last week, a number of people have pointed out that Article 18 in ICANN's current bylaws suggests that, quote, the principal office for the transaction of the business of ICANN shall be in the County of Los Angeles, State of California, U.S. of A. ICANN may also have additional office or offices within or outside the USA, as it may from time to time established. So that's in the bylaws now, and it does say shall be in the USA. So I believe that the principal office shall be in the USA is probably already in the bylaws, and it may not be necessary to put a finer point on 8B in bringing it over in the bylaws. That's certainly a discussion that this group could discuss. On 8C, Matthew, that's being brought over with one additional word, adding the word bottom-up so that it reads, operating as a multi-stakeholder, bottom-up, private sector-led organization with input from the public, whose benefit shall in all events act. The additional changes to the bylaws have to do with the reviews, the four periodic reviews that are in the affirmation of commitments. Now, that'll take a little bit longer, perhaps, to get through, Matthew, so I thought I would stop here. See if you wanted to take a few on the questions with respect to 4, 3, 4, 7, and 8. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for taking us through these various items and proposals. I'm checking whether there are any questions. I think your presentation was very clear, Steve, and I know there's been a lot of hard work by the group on this. I am seeing Caboose's hand up for a question. Caboose?
Yes.
You have the floor.
Yeah, first. The term affirmation of commitment was used, still is used, a relation between the NTIA and ICANN. If, and only if, a relevant part of affirmation of commitment is transferred to the bylaw, and, as I heard, and I think it is somewhere in the document, the remaining part of the AOC which is not transferred or which are not transferred to bylaw will be subject to deletions or terminations. Therefore, in the bylaw, we should not refer that I can commit itself. The term commit itself coming from the affirmation of commitment. If it goes to the bylaw, it's no longer commit. Today, I can, shall, or should, or something, but not commit, because there is no more commitment. This commitment is valid when we have this affirmation of commitment. If it goes to bylaw, and the remaining part will be terminated, the term commitment should not be used. This is one comment. Second comment, in page 46, there was a lengthy discussion in Working Party 1 about whether we say adequate or reasonable, or some people say sufficient. But the issue is quite simple. We are talking advance notice. Put some date, 30 days, 15 days, but not talking sufficient, adequate, reasonable. Advance notice is you notice someone ahead of time, within 30 days or within 15 days, put some date in the square bracket and leave it to the public comment to see whether they want opt for 15 days or 40 days or 75 days and so on and so forth, but not discussing sufficient, reasonable, and so on and so forth. So these are the two points that I have, and I request that we try to resolve the issue, no longer repeat, refer to the commitment in the bylaw, because it's no longer commitment. It is an obligation, whether you put it in the term shall or should or needed or required, that is something else, but not commit, because there's no longer affirmation of commitment. That will be, after transition, no longer valid. Thank you.
Thank you, Tavus. Jordan is next.
Thanks, Matthew. Jordan Carter here. The comment we've just heard is why part of me wanted to not show revised bylaw wording, because there's no use in us getting comments now from the public or from ourselves on the exact words used. The important point is to get the sense of what we're into. And that's what we need community input on. So we need to make sure our wording summons that up. We've tried to indicate that in paragraph F on page 43, just before this table. The second point I'd like to make is that there is a set of revised core commitments in the Working Party 2 work that's elsewhere in this document that Becky's team worked on. And there is a need to reconcile these proposals. We can't probably go out into public comment with different wording proposed for core values from different parts of this report. That would look a bit silly. So I think that's a job we'll need to work through in the course of the work days at the end of this week. Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan. Steve, maybe for a last word, and then we'll move to the next agenda item.
Caboose, what you mentioned about the affirmation being sunsetted, if in fact all these bylaws are brought over, that point is on page 43 of the document at item E. We added that after the last week's discussion. And I note with interest what you said about the word commit being brought over in paragraphs 3, 4, 7, and 8. And I'll note that it's only there twice on page 46. And I'll agree with you. You're right. The word commit doesn't appear in the entire ICANN bylaws. So the word commit should come out if it gets moved over, and it might just say the word shall. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And that's certainly something we'll get back to when we get into the intense work days. And I'd like to thank Cheryl, Steve, and the team on the stress test working party for their hard work, as well as Work Party 1, who has incorporated a number of the proposals. And I think we have a very consistent approach on this part of the report, which will be very useful later on. In the way to the public comment, even if we still have to fine-tune a number of items for consistency, which is perfectly normal at this stage. With that, I am moving with item number 4, which is about the timeline and agenda for the intensive work days on Thursday and Friday. So if we can move to the slides that were shared ahead of the meeting,
about the work days. The point of this slide is to introduce some of the general principles we may have to work around these work days. And you have scrolling control. So if you move to slide number 2, I'll be quick because I'm conscious of time. I'd like to remind our goal in these days, 2 days, is to prepare for the launch of a public comment. So what we are preparing is the soliciting of input from the community, and we are not going to present a consensus position. I think this is very important because that is the question we'll have to ask ourselves. Do we think this particular item deserves to be put in front of the community for comments, which is a very different question from do we have consensus? So it's not final approvals. We're not looking for consensus positions. We have the option in certain cases, although I hope it would be a limited number of cases, to put options in front of the community for its consideration and to receive guidance. And I think that's very important. We will also use our philosophy that has been ours from the start, that we should focus on requirements first and implementation as time permits. And that's certainly something, as we will be time pressured, that we need to use as much as possible when needed. And the test we have in terms of testing various options is, of course, what's enhancing ICANN's accountability, what's fitting with the CWG expectations. The principle I'm quoting is comply or explain, which basically says either we think that or more, or we explain why we would not do that. And, of course, the simplicity test that's been requested many times, especially in the Singapore meeting in ICANN. Kavus, I've seen your hand. I'll just go through the slides and move on to the question at the end. Expectations we have ahead of the call. The draft report has been circulated on Saturday. Hopefully you can all have read before the call the section 6, at least read section 6, which is basically where all the proposals are. We will try, with the rapporteurs, we're currently working on additional reading notes that would highlight the various discussion points based on, of course, the work party inputs. So the report itself highlights a number of open questions. The CWG expectations is the second input. The legal advice input, and we'll have the legal advisors in a minute on our call, is another input. And, of course, any points that's raised on the discussions on the list between last Saturday and the beginning of our calls is we're trying to pick up so that everyone's aware of what's being discussed. And we're fully aware that you will sometimes need to pick calls according to your topics of greater interest and of your various agendas. And remember, we don't take decisions on substance on one call only. We'll try to move through the structure of the frozen document for reference. The agenda that's been circulated highlights which section is going to be addressed at what point. The document is going to be shared in the AC room, and we are not going to change the version. This is the version you can now download. It's going to be our basis for discussion. And we will be lucky enough to have rapporteurs introduce the topics and, of course, have substantive discussion. To make it as inclusive as possible, we need short comments and substantive comments. And, of course, if there are objections, and I think we had a good example early on in this call, we need the rational or alternatives being voiced so that we can inform the discussion further. I think those are just simple rules. And between calls, we will try to circulate updated sections of the document based on our discussions. Of course, in edit mode, so everyone can see what has changed. And no final decision is made on the first reading anyway. And we have in the agenda a little bit of room, not much, to adjust day 2 discussions based on the day 1 debate. So we have a little room for flexibility here. And before turning to Kavus for a question, Alice has circulated a draft agenda. It's referencing the sections in the draft report that will be discussed. and we had to take into account the availability of rafters, and we, I must say, we have given a high priority of having the rafters, the relevant rafters available for the call. So that's not exactly the structure of the document. We're not taking it section by section, but it's still very, it's still going to be a good logic in the call that we've made sure there is consistency across this agenda. And with that short introduction, I'll turn to questions either on the agenda itself or on the general objectives and principles for the meeting, because obviously that this is an initial proposal by the co-chairs and it's there to be discussed. So, Caboose, you have the floor.
As Mathieu, the comment that I would like to make, I would wish to say before that I personally, as a participant to your group, have already admired and continue to admire and congratulate you, Thomas, Leon, Jordan, and Becky, and others for very, very valuable work that you have done. So the comment I'm trying to make is in no way should be considered as underestimating, undermining, or anything or criticism to your work. I wish that you introduce an introductory paragraph to the report saying that this is the output of the CCWDG, which for the time being does not reflect the consensus. We have to make it quite clear, because what I understood, you don't want any change. You don't accept any change at all. That is what I understood from your introduction. You want just to introduce and go ahead as soon as possible for public comment. That is good. That is very good. But we could not leave the impression that that document reflects the consensus. You could say in some area they may not reflect the consensus. You may put it in a little bit more latitude way or qualification. Not everything, but say that in some area they it may not reflect the consensus, at least leaving the room for future introductions of something. That is what I would like to suggest, if you and the other co-chairs accept. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose, and I think this is a very constructive proposal. So I thank you for that. It's valuable as ever for your comments. Any other comments on the way we're preparing the intense work days? I am seeing none. So obviously these rules will be reminded at the beginning of the first session. If there are any comments in between, of course they're welcome. But I do hope we can set that aside so that we can focus our intense work days on the substance, and we have a lot of substance, and it's very encouraging to see how substantial our report is and how actually consistent it looks like. I think we can be looking at the way we have been working collectively, and especially the rapporteurs in the working parties, with a certain amount of pride into how efficiently and quickly we've come that covered that ground. So with that, I am going to turn to Leon for the legal advice part of our call. And Leon, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Matthew. This is Leon Sanchez. With regards to the legal advice portion of our agenda, first of all, we have had two new documents coming in from the lawyers. The first one being the comparative chart with regards to the different models as in designator structure or membership structure on how can the rights that we are trying to provide the community with can be exercised, and also a second column in each model on how can the rights be enforced. This document was circulated previously to our call, and I hope you have had the chance to review it. It has, of course, laid out some questions for the legal sub-team as well as for the larger group, and we will be addressing those questions to the lawyers shortly. And we are currently in process of addressing the questions raised by the lawyers to the legal sub-team. We already have a draft that's pretty much with good progress, and we will be circulating this draft for the larger group, so we can all have a look at the provisional answers that we have drafted for the lawyers, and of course we will welcome any input as to, of course, at anything that we as legal sub-team might have missed in addressing the lawyers' questions, so they can, of course, provide us with further advice on the needs that we need to, or that we're looking to put in place. And with that in mind, we also received advice or opinions on the Working Party 2 templates. This document was just received some hours ago. It was my nighttime, which was Europe's morning time, I believe. It was also forwarded to the largest list. Of course, we don't expect that you have gone through the document already, but we do encourage reviewing the document before we have our intense day sessions. And just to add to the agenda of the intense day sessions that Matthew was discussing and pointed out, and that's been also circulated to the larger list, the legal sub-team will be holding a session at the end of day one. There's a note to this in the schedule that was sent out to the larger list, so you can all you of course are invited to attend this call should this interest you, and you are very welcome to join. And now I would like to of course give a framework to the lawyers on what we expect from them at this point. And I think the first thing we expect from the lawyers, and I will, of course, go to them in a moment, is to confirm the feasibility or the legal viability of all the different mechanisms and powers that we have put on the table. So from reading the documents that have been submitted so far, we do feel that there is legal viability, but we do want to have a clear confirmation from the lawyer's side as to whether what we're doing is legally viable. So we, of course, don't go into public comment without having this certainty that what we want to do or what we plan to do is legally viable. Of course, we would also want to assess or be aware of any risks on the various options of the legal aspects with very short and concrete answers. There were some questions raised by Chris Despain on the list yesterday night, too. Yesterday night, I mean my night time, of course. And they have already been assigned to the lawyers for answering. But of course, Chris, if you want to address this question, or you want to raise these questions at this call, of course, feel free to do so. And the lawyers, of course, will provide the best reply they can in the time we have. And finally, we have to confirm the final proposal feasibility. When we have decided this, of course, providing the details. And we need, of course, as I said, to clearly state and confirm that the IRP process is, in fact, able to be binding the board. So with this in mind, I would like to hand the floor to Holly Gregory so she can take us through the chart, the comparison chart, and of course very briefly through the Working Party 2 templates legal assessment so far, and then we'll open the floor for questions. So Holly, could you please take the floor, and I would kindly ask you to of course keep it as short as possible, and first try to address the question on confirming the legal viability of what we're doing here. So Holly, you have the floor.
So thank you very much, Leon, and I'm going to in a minute lean on my team a little bit. I want to hear both from Josh and I think Rosemary. I want to say at the outset that we think that the things you want to do are largely possible, and then I want to say that the devil is in the details, as we've been saying, and there is a component that rests on how you decide to organize yourselves, as we've said at the outset, whether you take a member organization route or a more formal designator route, or you have something that's looser like what you have now, very much dictates the kinds of powers that the community can exercise. And so it's not possible, Leon, to give you that clear, straightforward answer on each of your mechanisms about whether they're legally viable. Viability is going to rest in part on how you address those key decisions, which in some measure is why we provided you with the set of questions that we provided the other day to help us better understand what your priorities are and what you might trade off, because there are some trade-offs here. And we've been trying to help you assess what some of those trade-offs are. For example, with membership, you can have some greater powers, but you may have concerns about whether the community really wants to be organized into a membership organization. Similarly, with the designator model, we believe that we can do some of the things that you want to do. We think there's much greater complexity in doing that, and we think that for some of the things that you may want to do in a designator model, it's more difficult to have. So with that being said, Josh or Rosemary, do you want to walk through the chart in detail? Josh, is that something that you'd like to do?
Sure. I mean, Rosemary and I can go through this together if that's what the community wants. But I'd ask that the staff put the governance memo and the governance chart up as opposed to this memo, because that's the one we'd be speaking to. Yeah, that's correct.
Yes.
The first thing we do is, so this chart actually focuses on, as Holly said, there are a number of questions and that we pose to you all to help us understand really what those priorities are, and we're getting some feedback. We've seen some discussion in the listserv, and Leon, I think, is trying to pull that together into a sort of hopefully consensus-oriented statement. The chart is a bit hard to read, so perhaps what I can do, I don't expect everybody to be able to read on this call, but we can explain the layout briefly at the beginning. And we were requested, as I said, it focuses on the, I think, six powers that have been articulated as sort of principal powers that, or core powers that there's interest in the community having with respect to establishing greater accountability for ICANN and the ICANN board. And those are, you know, the full board recall, the ability to recall individual directors, the ability to approve, you know, amendments generally to the articles or bylaws, the ability to approve changes to the golden bylaws or fundamental bylaws. They've been called different things, but that's just shorthand for the same thing, but principal bylaws or articles provisions, and then the ability to approve the strategic plan and the annual budget. the way that the chart breaks out, we articulate it under either the designator model or the membership model. So in other words, an ICANN that's organized with designators selecting the board members, or an ICANN that's organized with members selecting the board members. We articulate how those rights are established, so where can they be created, and then how they can be exercised, and how they can be enforced if necessary. That's the way we've set this up, and it's done for both sides. There are a few general comments in the document that you see in italics that are applicable to, you know, sort of kind of key decision issues and or key explanations that are important to your sort of general understanding of what we're saying in the chart. But I can summarize, I'm just mindful of time in the agenda, sort of we could summarize going through each of these, but let me pause for a minute and ask Leon, you know, do you want us to take you through each of them now, or do you want to reserve on that because people may or may not have had a lot of time to ask to think about these or consider questions?
I would reserve on that at this moment, so we can, of course, provide people with more time to have a deeper reflection on this. But, of course, if you could just provide with a very brief walkthrough, that would be okay.
Okay. Well, let me – I think the simplest way to do this is – because really there are two sort of distinctions or two groupings here. I think groupings 1 through 4, powers 1 through 4, full board recall, individual director recall, and approving amendments to the articles or bylaws and approving changes to the golden bylaws or articles. Those four, I don't want to say that they're largely the same, whether you're under a designator or not, but what we believe is that those powers can be exercised, and there's, you know, sort of precedent and statutory authority for directors exercising each of those, you know, four powers. I mean, sorry, for both designators and for members exercising each of those four powers. In the corporate law, members, as Holly said, have broader rights, but the designators have been, it has been articulated specifically that the designators have the ability to replace, you know, to designate their board member and to replace their board member and to approve amendments to articles or bylaws. Usually it's done as specific articles that are set forward, you know, that are set out in what you all have called the golden bylaws, and not necessarily broad approval. But that's a little bit of, you know, devil in the details and things that can be worked out. To that end, the important thing is to articulate clearly in the bylaws what kind of, which amendments will be subject to approval of designators or members, if it's, you know, if it's a member one and it's going to be less than the whole. In addition, with full board recall, it will probably be the case, the principle is achievable, but it will be the case that there will need to be some contractual machinations to make this, or some triggers that will need to be required or written into the bylaws or into contracts that will enable this to happen. But the principle is achievable that the either designators or members could spill the whole board or recall the whole board, excuse me, if necessary. Let me pause there for a minute and see if Rosemary has anything she wants to add on the first four powers before we get into a discussion of this approving the strategic plan or approving, you know, the annual budget.
Thanks, Josh. This is Rosemary. No, I think you're right that the first four, while there are differences in the details of how you might implement this or that power, some might rely more on contract, others could be done directly in the bylaws without an external contract. The first four are definitely in a different category from the last two.
Okay. And so I don't take the whole discussion. Rosemary, do you want to sort of start with an explanation of the what makes the last two different, and Holly and I can chime in?
Sure. Happy to do that. So the last two are approving the strategic plan and approving the budget. And the word approve has already, I see, created some issues in the chat, and they are ongoing issues that I think your legal counsel have had trying to understand what it is you want to do. And as a result, well, let me first say that the approve the strategic plan is really where we've laid out our thinking, and then under approve the budget, we've just basically said it's the exact same. So we're really now only looking at approve the strategic plan, which is page, I'm not sure what page it is of the document, but someone will type that in for me, I hope. It's the Annex A-6, but I think it's further on in the document, like maybe 12 or something like that. This is the key of where I think we really see a difference between the designator model and the membership model, and it would apply equally whether we're talking about the ability to approve the strategic plan or approve a budget. And because we weren't entirely sure what you meant by approve, I think we've kind of tried to tease that apart in some of the where can the right be created. We've kind of put some different thoughts about depending on what you mean by reconsider, approve, veto, all of those terms that I think need to be teased out further and that are in our legal counsel questions to the legal subteam. The big difference in the answers between the designator model and the membership model are that the corporate law contemplates members being able to second-guess the board, to overturn board decisions, to reject board decisions, to approve board decisions. I'm not quite sure exactly what language you want to use there, but the members by statute are granted that authority, which is essentially a big exception to the corporate law rule, not just California, but I would say more broadly, at least throughout the United States, the corporate law rule that directors, the board of directors collectively, holds final authority, fiduciary duties over the corporation and over the decisions they make for the corporation, and that therefore doing things that impinge on those fiduciary duties are problematic. Except members are given this right in the corporate law, essentially, even though members have no fiduciary duties. Now, whether it's a good idea for members to exercise it a lot is a different issue, but they are given that right in the corporate law. They are the only third parties given that right in the corporate law. And designators, therefore, fall in this other category of people who are not, they aren't the status of members. They have certain rights that are set out in statute that are in the first four powers, the recall the board, the recall individual directors, and the bylaws and articles changes, being able to veto articles and bylaws changes. But they just, in order to give them this authority to redo a board decision, it appears to us, after a good bit of discussion, that there's no way to do it in the bylaws. If you put it in the bylaws, it will violate the corporate law provision that says that the board has to have this ultimate authority. So then you're left with coming up with a contractual regime on the designator side to try and achieve the same result as you could under the bylaws on the membership side. That's my high-level summary. Ingrid, do you want to add something?
Well, this is Ingrid Mittermeier here with Rosemary in the office. I think my understanding of some of the further discussions I saw about what is meant by the sort of veto concept is that really the interest is in having a process where if the board, let's say, approves an initial strategic plan or a budget, and then there is this process in the community to raise objections to it, that after that process occurs, it goes back to the board to reconsider. And so it's a, you know, it is a little bit more of a narrow idea of the board approves, it, the community raises concerns, and then it goes back to the board for further consideration versus the decision being taken completely away from the board. So when Rosemary is touching on the idea that the members could even more drastically make their decision themselves, et cetera, we understand that's not really what's on the table here. Nonetheless, the fact that legally the members even would have that right makes it easier to give the stakeholders in a membership structure the more tailored right to do what I think you do really intend here, which is to have a process where it then gets, you know, where there's input from the community and then it goes back to the board for further consideration. That clearly can be done. I think there is a very much a concern about the fiduciary duties of how that interacts with the fiduciary duties of the board, which needs to be always honored here.
This is Josh. Let me just close out, and I know Holly has some actually more. I'll hand it to Holly next, but I did want to say, because Jordan, I've seen some discussion and emails from you on the serve about, and in the chat now there was discussion about the right words to describe this, whether it's reconsideration, approval, or veto. And I think what's important is the principle, because to consider if the community has the ability, and I use the community as a lowercase community, but if there are third parties that have the ability to prevent the board from moving forward, whether you call it a reconsideration or an unlimited number of reconsiderations, as I think was one of the things that had been considered, you know, with only a temporary, like a temporary spending measure, if there is a third party that has the ability to prevent the board from moving forward with managing the affairs of the corporate, of the company, that is going to be viewed or considered effectively a blocking right, and a right that potentially could be against public policy and in the interests of the board and the statutory responsibility of the board having the ultimate authority and responsibility to direct the affairs of the company. So when you are trying to impose those kinds of restrictions outside of a member model, using as Rosemary articulated, using designators, or using contracts with designators, if your contract itself runs contrary to that sort of guiding principle, by imbuing too much power in the hands of the designators to prevent the board from carrying out its duties, I mean, you risk that, obviously there's potential to risk to the stability of the organization, but you, just as a legal matter, the validity of those contracts are at risk, because it would not be acceptable for the board to enter into that kind of arrangement, or enforceable. So we have been asked, I mean, Leon, you did ask whether there were some simple and concrete answers, and in some instances there are, when you choose a member model, if you were to choose a member model, I should say, but if ultimately you choose a designator model for other reasons, equally valid, it may make some of these powers and enforcement mechanisms much more vulnerable in your ability to put them in place, or much more suspect, I should say. So with that, Holly, did you have anything you wanted to add in closing it out?
No, I think that you said it well. I think that that's a good high-level description of sort of where we find things at the moment and the concerns that led us to pose our questions to you so that we could get a better understanding of your concerns and priorities so that we could help best advise you, if you will.
And Leon, I know you want to open it up for questions. I just want to remind people, this so far we're just focusing on the governance chart and the powers. the second memo, which we haven't discussed at all, does get into descriptions or evaluations of, you know, the actual sort of process around escalation and internal review mechanisms and the like.
Thanks. Yes. Now I will open the floor, of course, for questions. But first, what I'm hearing is that so far, legal viability of what we're proposing is in fact viable, but ultimate implementation, feasibility, and complexity will depend on whether we go with the membership model or a designator model. And this will, of course, will need to be addressed at a later stage. But so far, I think that with this very high-level idea of that what we're doing here is, in fact, to some extent, viable or legally viable, we can continue to carry on with our work. I see two hands raised, actually three, but somehow two have disappeared. I remember seeing Cavu's hand up, but now it's not up. I also saw Thomas Richard's hand up, but now it's not up. And I see Jordan Carrett as first in queue. So, Jordan, could you please take the floor?
Thank you. Jordan here. Thanks for that discussion, guys, Josh in particular. The thing, the two principles with this power that I think are important are the right to, for the community at the end of the process to send the document back, whether it's a budget or a strategic plan, and that it not be implemented while it's sent back. And the reason that we kind of struggled with the language veto or whatever is because it is a reconsideration process. The point is that it goes back for reconsideration by the board with information about what the issue is, and that it isn't implemented while it's set back. So, you know, the idea behind taking that approach was to be respectful of the fiduciary duties of the board. And I think that's the bit that needs some more untangling here. You know, and it's important, I think, building on that, that the set of powers we have here in terms of the validity of them can't just lead you always back to a board spill as the ultimate enforcement. I don't think that's an adequate set of responses for the community if all of our powers are built back to that one ability through designators or members to remove the directors. I also heard in your comments that the designator model might be tricky to implement this even with the set of contracts due to fiduciary duties. So for me, the important principle is that these issues like bylaws can be sent back, and that if the board keeps bashing its head against a proposal that the community doesn't want, it will just remain unable to implement it. And that choice still lies with the board. You know, they're still the decision maker. They're the people who decide what goes in the budget and what they're proposing to the community. If the power that we're seeking here is to just fail to implement or fail to complete that if they are not in accord with the community's wishes. Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan.
I would love to be able to address that. Jordan, thank you for that. Jordan, thank you very much for that comment. It's a very clear and crisp comment and direction. And if that is the consensus of the group, it helps us greatly. I think the notion of not thinking of this as a veto, but thinking of it as reconsideration, where the board still has the ultimate decision, but it's been kicked back to them for more work, is a very, very helpful construct in a fiduciary duty system. I would continue to feel much better about it in a member structure, but I think that it makes a lot of good sense. And I agree with you that to the extent that we're only relying on a spill the board as the ultimate enforcement mechanism, that's not satisfying. That's another reason why you've heard us say that we're more comfortable with a member structure, because we think that we can create bylaws that, by and large, if you needed to go into a court would help to enforce. So, and we're talking about creating other kinds of internal mechanisms for enforcement as well, but ultimately, if you ever get into a significant dispute between the board and the community organized in some kind of way in which the community has the ability to assert rights, then you do need sort of ultimately that kind of court backing. And we think that that's probably much more available for this kind of circumstance, a reconsideration right in a member model. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Holly. Next in the queue is Caboose.
Yes. First questions. First of all, in less than 3 days, we received 3 to 4 bulky documents, totally legal, very, very complex. Some of us are lawyers, I'm not. Some of us has legal background, I have some. Some others does not have legal background, but then goes to the community for public situation is much more difficult. The situation is that we have to have a clear distinction between the two models. When you describe the two models, distinguished lawyers, you try to say this one has this advantage, the other one has other advantages. At the end, the way you describe that, it becomes equal. But I see your tendency for the government, for the member model, that you try to inject the idea with member model, things going better. But this does not describe the difficulty of that, the complexity of that, the implementation of that, and the time of that. I don't start from the distinction between the two. I start from objectives. We have two group of objectives. Objectives, group one is removal of individual board, removal of entire board, and the change of the bylaw. The second group is budget and the strategy. If we can deal with the budget and the strategy in the reconsideration manner and send them for reconsideration, and if it is not agreed by the board, then we recourse to the removal of the board, that might resolve the problem rather than going to membership. I know some people are very, very sensitive to member models, and they may totally disagree with me that they want the member model. But I see that very, very complex. Unless and until the time we see the considerable amount of changes required for members and required for the designators, we cannot decide on anything, and that would be very unexpected that we decide so quickly which one is better. Because you also did not very clearly mention, distinguished lawyers, that what model really has less complexity, has less time for implementation, and is less costly, and so on and so forth. You try to counterbalance each model at the end, saying that designator is simple in this, but you cannot achieve that one. You need to have the contract. Having the contract, you have this complexity. At the end, you become that both of them are complex. So we still do not have a clear idea. I'm sure that if you organize another 5 sessions, still you come to the same question, saying that devil are in the details. But when we can have these details? Unless we have 2 lines, one line, the changes of the bylaw and the contract or articles for member, and change of bylaw and articles and so on and so forth for the designators. Then we can, and then implementation time and the cost and complexity, then we could decide. I don't think that it is very easy question that you raised, that first we have to decide member or designator, and then you provide the details. Still, we are not clear of the advantage and disadvantage. It would be very, very difficult. This is one question. The second question is more important. You have mentioned in one of your documents that you need to review the document before going to public comments. Are you dealing with the document which is prepared by end of this week? You want to review that before going to public comments, or you are dealing with another document? So that is a logistic problem, and the co-chairs and others should know that, whether they have to send the document to you first for your comment and include your comment as a comment of the lawyers into the document in a separate column or not. So I think this is a question to ask, but I am not still clear between the two versions that you have proposed. I am in favor of the less complex, less costly, and more easily implementable than a very, very complex text. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Cavus. And, well, just to try to address your first concern, which I think is a very valid one, we will be asking the lawyers to provide us with some really simple summary in each of their memos, so we can, of course, help those who are, first, not lawyers, and second, non-U.S. lawyers, to better understand in very simple, lean terms what the memo is about, and, of course, try to have a better understanding on the different issues that are being addressed in each memo. With regards to your second question, I might as well turn to maybe Josh Hoffheimer or Rosemary Faye. Do you want to comment on this?
So I think that the second question, really, actually, I'd turn it back to the legal subteam to ask what you all want from us. The comment that was made in our documents was referring to, you know, as it does progress, that we'd be happy to, you know, get into the, and decisions are made as to which structure to deploy, you know, we'd be happy to get into the weeds, of course, around, you know, the actual governance documents and language and particular modalities to make things work. But I think before you get to that, there's the threshold question of what you're looking for from us this week with regard to the actual draft proposal. And are there, you know, and how do you want us to serve and be of assistance to you all? I mean, obviously, we know we're going to be participating on calls and answering questions, but are you expecting, you know, would you want us to be drafting any particular portions initially to help articulate certain ideas? Would you be asking us to simply be reviewing the documentation that is being generated or the additional drafts, or do you just want to take in sort of our views alongside you in consideration and you'll put together, you know, the proposal however you want it, and that'll be what you send out? I think we need some guidance from you all on, you know, what role you want Sidley and Adler to play over the coming days.
Good.
I'm going to pause there and not answer the first question from Cavus, which is, you know, a pretty complex question. And you know, I respectfully, I think we've been saying that there is complexity in different ways. But from our perspective, we need, and that's why we asked the five questions, we need some understanding of what are the critical gating items for this community that will drive certain decisions, because I don't think anybody wants to make a decision just because it's cheaper to do it one way without considering what the impact on their goals and priorities would be.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this, Josh. And well, as it's been said in the legal subteam list, of course, we would welcome to have one member of your team on each and every call for this intense day sessions. And we're asked just state whether what we're talking about is feasible or not. And we would expect a more active discussion or a more active participation on Section 6 of the document, which is the different mechanisms that we will be trying to implement. And, of course, we will be going deeper into this discussion tomorrow in our legal subteam group. I am mindful of the time. We are just hitting the top of the hour at this point. So, Rosemary, if you want to add something in a really, really brief fashion.
Yes, please. I am concerned at the idea of the endless, not limited reconsideration that essentially blocks the board from acting. I think you can do that in a membership structure, and I don't believe you're going to be able to do it in a designator structure. I'm not trying to disagree with anything Holly said. I think I'm just trying to be clear about that unlimited reconsider with a block on anything going forward while the reconsideration is going on is going to be problematic in the designator model in a way that it is not problematic in the membership model.
Good. Thank you very much, Rosemary. Now I'd like to hand the call back to Thomas for final remarks and, of course, invite all of you who are interested in the legal issues to join us tomorrow in our call of the legal sub-team. So, Thomas, I'll go back to you.
Thank you very much, Leon, and I'm going to keep this very brief. I will not touch upon the first couple of agenda items because I think we are clear on where we stand with the stress test. The conversation is going to continue on those. The CEWG interrelation is going to be clear, so we know exactly what to do there. With respect to legal advice, I think we've made good progress in understanding further the pros and cons of the different implementation models. We got confirmation, and I think this is the good news, that the requirements that we have are implementable, but that there are different levels of complexity depending on the choice that's being made by our group. And I think that what we will need to think about further is, and I think this is where we have to closely liaise with the lawyers directly and through the legal sub-team, is that we need to get all the facts on the pros and cons for the various models. And then it's for our group to make a recommendation to the community what trade-offs we can make. And the points that have been raised by various members of this group as well as by the lawyers are that we need to take into account the ease of implementation, the risks, the cost, and all those factors. But I think that we're getting a clearer view on what's possible, where the limitations are, and we're going to continue this discussion in the next couple of days. With that, I would like to close this call. Thank all of you for your continued attention to this matter and for your valuable inputs, and we're looking forward to continuing working with you in the next couple of days intensively and in the weeks to come. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.